Claro.
I think you two need to talk
House Committee on Judiciary come to order.
Wearing.
Today is February 12th, 2015. First item is the introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as a committee bill, or the following LC, singular, LC 3663, dated January 27, 2015.
Representative Williamson moves to introduce the LC as committee as a committee measure. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. We're going to go out of order on the agenda today. We're going to open and first, because two of them are together, so we're going to go down and have open a public hearing on House Bill 2384.
As Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2384 comes to us at the request of the Attorney General. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendments before us today. Under current Oregon law, it is unclear whether service of civil investigative demands by the Department of Justice may be served on natural persons in the same manner as unnatural persons. And for those at home, unnatural persons are juridical persons or groups of people who acquire legal personhood when they are incorporated. Corporations are the classic example. Natural persons acquire legal personhood upon birth. House Bill 2384 clarifies the DOJ's service process for civil investigative demands and authorizes service on natural persons to be done in the same manner as on unnatural persons. House Bill 2384 parallels the rules of service contained presently in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. House Bill 2384 also contains many Scrivener's changes. They do things like change the word any to and shall be to is, among other non-substantive changes.
Okay, thank you. Sherilyn. Heemstra, I think so. You say that? It's spelled like Heemstra, but I'll go with you.
Heemstra is correct. Yeah. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice here on House Bill 2384. I'm going to have to get into the weeds a little bit today, so bear with me. But first, the 10,000-foot view. The Attorney General is responsible for enforcing the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which is our consumer protection law. And that is where we sort of got the idea for this bill today. Under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, we send out civil investigative demands, or CIDs. And what happens when we're going after scammers often is we'll have a corporation, say Corporation A, open up. They'll start scamming a few people. We'll start getting complaints. And then by the time the heat is on to them, they've opened up Corporation B, and we kind of go round and round and round. One way we found to combat that problem is to serve the natural person, the actual individual behind the scam. So here's where we get into the weeds. With civil investigative demands, as the law is currently written, there's sort of a strange thing in the statute. We're not really sure why it was there, but some have interpreted it to be as not applying the same service rules. So these civil investigative demands are pre-litigation and investigative tools. And what happens, as the law is currently written, the service is different for the natural person and the unnatural person. With the natural people we're trying to serve, they are sometimes fairly good at evading service as they are scam artists. So what we're trying to do here is just clarify that the rules will be the same. This will save us approximately about 12 cases a year where we can't serve the natural person and the investigation goes cold because we're not able to do that substitute service. And so that's the problem, that's the fix, and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2384. Open work session on House Bill 2384.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2384 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2384 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion there
for this one?
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Barton, would you want to carry that one?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Talk about natural and unnatural.
Yes. Representative Widener might have a question or two about that. Okay, open a public hearing. Should we go ahead and do them both at the same time? Okay, we'll open a combined public hearing on House Bill 2601 and 2603.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, starting with House Bill 2601, which is sponsored by Representatives Smith, Warner, Fagan, and Kenny Guyer. There are no revenue impact on this bill and minimal fiscal impact, no amendments before us today. So in 1989, the Oregon legislature mandated that the Oregon State Police establish and maintain the Missing Children's Clearinghouse. The OSP Criminal Investigation Division maintains the clearinghouse, which collects, stores, and disseminates information about Oregon's missing children in an effort to locate them. There have been discussions, problems identified with the clearinghouse, specifically that has not always listed all of Oregon's missing children. I conducted a comparison just yesterday to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and while the national system presently lists 43 missing Oregon children, the Missing Children Clearinghouse lists 40. House Bill 2601 requires members of law enforcement agencies to notify Oregon State Police's Missing Children Clearinghouse within 24 hours of receiving a report of an abducted child. Moving to House Bill 2603, Chair Barker, members of the committee, this is sponsored by Representative Smith Warner. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, no amendments before us. House Bill 2603 possesses roots originating from a 2004 Senate Task Force on Parental and Family Abductions. That task force laid the foundation for the passage of House Bill 1041 during the 2005 legislative session that addressed civil damages for custodial interference and made Oregon the first state to create a civil cause of action for child abduction. House Bill 1041, codified at ORS 30.868, became known as Aaron's Law to honor the memory of Aaron Cruz, the eldest son of Sean Cruz, who died in Utah in April 2005 as a consequence of his abduction. House Bill 2603 mandates that ORS 30.868 be known and may be cited as Aaron's Law.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I have the honor to represent House District 45, which covers Northeast Portland, Park Rose, and Maywood Park. I'm here before you today because, as I think you'd all agree, representing constituents is really the greatest honor in what we get to do. And Sean Cruz, at whose behest these bills were submitted, is probably known by many of you. He spent years of dedicated service here in this building. He worked for Senator Avell Gordley for a number of years. And he came to me with some unfinished business from his time here. So as you've heard briefly, in 2004, Senator Gordley convened a task force on parental and family abduction, which was inspired by Sean's unfortunate experience, which he will talk further about in his testimony. The task force reported out 4 recommendations to the 2005 legislative session, which have been implemented with varying levels of success. The bills before you today both stem from that task force work. First is House Bill 2601, which requires members of law enforocement agency who receive a report of an abducted child to notify the Oregon State Police Missing Children Clearinghouse within 24 hours of receiving that report. This is one of the recommendations from the task force. Let me read to you the language from the task force. In recommendation 3, it says, at one point, the task force considered legislation that would have required that all local law enforcement agencies report missing children to the Oregon State Police, Missing Children's Clearinghouse. However, after the state police and the Department of Justice met and discussed the issue, they determined that the state police could obtain this information by an administrative process that will automatically notify the Missing Children's Clearinghouse of all reports of missing children made by state, county, and local law enforcement agency. However, over time, it has not worked out as hoped. We have talked to the state police about this, and they are neutral on this bill. We do understand that we are going to need an amendment because this language only requires the transmission and not the posting to the list itself. And so we will have that for you eventually. This is one of those things where I think over time, if you think about Amber Alerts and the way we think of most, like the really significant high-level missing child notification,
applications that we hear about now, that kind of has come to dominate it. Yet these other situations are just as critical and just as crucial to the families of these kids, particularly these ones that have been the victims of parental and family abductions. So that is where we are in 2601. So as I said, we will have an amendment on that dealing with the posting as well. And on the House Bill 2603, was passed in 2005, known as Senate Bill 1041, and it made abducting a child a civil cause of action. This came from Sean's own experience and was referred to as Aaron's Law. It's been referred to that way at conferences on family and civil law, and yet officially it is not known as that. And so House Bill 2603 will put that into statute to have it known as Aaron's Law. So at that, I would like to pause and give Sean the opportunity to give his testimony. But thank you for having me, and I'm, of course, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Cruz?
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Aaron Cruz. I took my son's name as my own middle name after he passed. I'm very grateful to the committee for hearing these bills. And I'd like to begin my testimony by calling the committee's attention to this headline in the Oregonian, Sunday Oregonian, February 11th, 1996. And today, February 12th, marks the 19th anniversary to the day that my kids disappeared. And what I wanted the committee to have a sense of is what was going on in the state at the time. A group of people, some of which I knew and some of which I didn't know, had custody of my kids and were shuttling them around between Oregon and Washington, and then disappeared on Monday, February 12th was my last contact. And at that time, I-5 was closed, flooding at Tacoma, I-84 was closed in the gorge. I had no idea where to look. And what happens, as I came to learn, you know, from personal experience, but also reflecting other parents in similar situations that had contacted me over the years, and also conversations with court personnel, which told me at the very beginning that things like this happen all the time. They say all the time it happens. And, under law, present at the time, the only options that you have when your children are abducted by a family member or a group of people that would include a family member, a parent, is either the criminal process or the family law process. And they're both barriers to anything actually happening. In the family law process, you have to serve the other party before anything happens, but you don't know where they are, and they have your children. And in the criminal process, there's barriers that are actually built into the statute, and that is in the language of the statute itself, which says the person must intend to take the child permanently or for a protracted period of time. But there's no statutory definition of protracted. When the bill first came, when we first talked about this, let me back up for a second. I first came to the Capitol in the 2001 legislative session, and that was when I came and met with Senator Gordley and her legislative aide, Sharon Hill, and I related all of my experience between 1996 and 2001, up until that time, and Senator Gordley prompts to do something about it. And then the following year, she offered me the job, a legislative aide, and I came to the Capitol in 2003, and our first, when I came into the Capitol, I just believed strongly that the problem was that the law wasn't strong enough. I had a joint custody order that had been in effect for 5 years. Every decision made by both parents together, and that had actually worked fine for 5 years until, bang, one day it all disappeared. It all went away in one day. And our first draft, LC draft, you know, reflected that the law needs to be stronger. But when the draft came back up from Legislative Council, and we met with the Judicial Department, and really walked me through an understanding of the law, I came to realize that really the law is, it's 5 years in prison. That really is strong enough, and it's pretty clear. A person commits the crime. It makes no distinction between parents and other family members and non-family members. It's a person commits the crime. But the systems kind of funnel you into this where it's a parent versus a parent, even if that's not the case. And the first time I testified on this issue was in this room in the 2003 legislative session. And the Senate president appointed the task force on parental and family abductions that was co-chaired by Senator Gordley and Senator Frank Morse. And I was one of the people that testified before that task force, as were people who were adults who had been abducted by a parent as a child. And they testified about their experiences. And generally out there, the general feeling that people have, the general public as well as the people that are in the system, law enforcement, courts, social service providers, is that if the kids are with a family, it's not that bad. And I can't tell you how many tens of thousands of times I heard people tell me, don't worry, Sean, it'll be okay. You know, it'll work out okay. The day my kids disappeared, I reported to my employer that my kids had disappeared. And he asked me, are they with their mother? And I said, I don't know, she's missing too. And he said, don't worry, it'll all be all right. And 2 weeks later, he fired me without notice for not having my mind on my job. And so at the time, I was my mother's sole caregiver. She was medically fragile, and I'd been her caregiver for a year, raising my four kids and my mom, taking care of my mom. And that's all my life was about in that year. And then it all just went away. And what I found is that not much has changed for parents out there. You know, to this day, I'm not aware of a single lawyer in this state who's familiar with ORS 30.868 and what it's supposed to do. When parents contact me, you know, because they're desperate, they can't find anybody to help them, I don't know anybody to refer them to. I've even tried test runs with the Oregon State Bar Referral Service. You know, there's no category there, if you go to that page, that is going to lead you anywhere if this is your problem. And I've even, you know, left messages, my kids have disappeared, a joint custody order, don't know where they are. And the referrals I've gotten back, nobody's ever returned my call. And I've also checked on the lawyers that I was referred to, and, you know, they're typically just fresh out of law school. There's no possible way they know anything about this issue. So I wanted to explain to you some of the features of Aaron's Law and why it's important. It's really not about suing the other parent, you know. It's not about that at all. It's about holding the people that are responsible for taking a child, enticing the child, and keeping the child in violation of the custodial statute. In a lot of cases, a criminal prosecution isn't your goal. I never wanted to have my ex-wife charged with a crime. All it did was hurt my case, my cause, hurt my children, hurt everything. And not only that, when the assistant district attorney in Washington County did file the criminal charges and the grand jury returned the indictment, that really made the family court proceeding that was going on in Clark County, it made the judge and the guardian ad litem that furious at me. I was the person that was causing harm to my own kids because I had filed criminal charges. And I knew that there were people that knew where my children were. I didn't know where my wife was, my ex-wife. She wasn't fleeing from me. She wasn't fleeing from the guy, her husband that was, she was in a divorce proceeding with at the time. There was no violence in that relationship. It was just an unfortunate short-term marriage that didn't work out. And she wasn't fleeing from anybody here, but she was being influenced by a group of people in her church congregation that were in three states that made it all happen. So while I'm desperately searching for my kids out here, arrangements have already been made for them to live in Utah. There's housing, employment ready. Everybody that was involved in that knew I had a joint custody order for 5 years. And they had determined that I was hostile to their point of view and decided to execute a shunning. And that's what it's always been and what it is today. And that is that neither the family law system or the criminal law system ever got that. And again, I didn't want to press criminal charges against her. I would have loved to press the charges against everybody else. But I found, and of course when you're desperately looking for somebody to help you find your children, the Yellow Pages isn't much help, and when you do contact a law office, the first thing the family law lawyer will tell you is they don't do criminal law. And where else do you go? Criminal defense lawyers aren't going to help you. There's really no place to go. And when the criminal process or the court process is underway, you find that the only time anybody is doing anything at all, even if it's shuffling papers that's related to your children, it only happens between Monday and Friday during working hours. All the rest of the week, you know, you can't sleep, you can't eat, you don't know where your children are, and nobody's doing anything about it. Week after week after week, and you all are familiar with how long it takes to get a hearing date. You know, I've had the experience of waiting 2 months for a hearing date to try to get an order for contact with my kids and find that the other side fired their lawyer on the courthouse steps the morning of the hearing. And that automatically bought them a whole bunch of time. I've also had the experience of standing there in the courtroom trying to win a court order for summer visitation to the kids that I have a right to. I always had them for half the summer. And listening to the lawyers and the judge talk about how they're going to schedule the next hearing to actually make a decision on this proposal, and they're trying to figure out how to schedule around their vacations. I've had that experience, too. I've had the experience of having to start to try to get visitation with my kids for the summer, starting a year in advance, and find the lawyers that are providing cover for the abduction able to delay everything all the way to the end of the summer. So there's only a few days left before school begins in Utah, and they're definitely not going to let them out. So anyhow, the first thing about Aaron's Law is it's alternative to criminal path. It also gives the victim parent some measure of control, because once you go the criminal path, there you don't have any control in what happens there, and the same thing is true in the family law path. You don't have any control. The system is going to do what it does. But if ORS 30.868 had been on the books in 1995, what I would have done is I would have filed civil suit against everybody that I knew that was involved in moving my kids around. I'd want to see their emails, their phone records, a record of their contacts with my kids. And I would sue them for everything they had. You know, also, ORS 30.868 has a counseling provision in it that stems directly from the prior work of the Family Law Task Force, which sought to reduce the incidence of divorce in the state. And that idea, you know, you have to have counseling before you can get a divorce in Oregon now. So what we wanted was to be able for the court to order the parties, everybody involved in this abduction, to undergo counseling directed at educating them of the harm they're causing these kids and pay for the counseling. So we felt very strongly that these, if the public, if the legal systems knew about these tools, then people would be less inclined to participate in an abduction, particularly if it's somebody else's kids. And then we also recognize, you know, Senator Gordley was a champion for many, many years on mental health issues, and particularly mental health parity. And, you know, in the statute, the custodial interference statute, it only refers to, you know, the statute is triggered if you expose the child to illness or physical harm. But this is a mental health parity state. And the task force heard much testimony about how harmful the emotional abuse in an abduction by any person, even a parent, causes the child, similar to that suffered by victims of sexual abuse, and that it can take years for the child to become an adult and then start to deal with everything that has happened and think about that. And this is also where we were addressing the issue of statute of limitations, because, you know, a custodial interference one, it's only 3 years, even if they keep the kids longer than that. Technically, the statute isn't supposed to run while the kids are out of state, but I never saw that happening. It meant no difference in my case, none whatsoever. And so the thing is, and also there's nothing in there for the children. It's still a matter of other systems that are making decisions about these children's lives that it'll affect them the rest of their lives. And so under ORS 30.868, the child victim acquires the right to seek civil damages against those parties that did whatever damage was done. And that window stays open for 6 years. And so we thought not only that provides a measure of judgment, but gee, that ought to discourage somebody from participating in an abduction. And there's still some unfinished business in terms of things that we hope that the committee, the legislature, will take a look at in the future. And one of those is finding a statutory definition of protracted, which is where the 24 hours reporting comes in. Law enforcement they're looking at a statutory of the child must be taken for a protracted period of time, but nobody knows how long that is. And we know how busy law enforcement is, under budgeted and overworked. So boy. There's also the issue of a continuing crime. And this is another thing that hardly anybody understands. People perceive an abduction or the violation of custodial interference as something that happened on that day. And then there's a statute that runs from that day for 3 years. But it's something that happened a long time ago. I can't tell you how many times people have asked me, gee, Sean, it's been 7 years. You know, when are you going to move on? You know, it's been 12 years. When are you going to move on? People are still asking me that. 19 years. When are you going to move on? But these are my children. And I know you all know what that means. It's not something that you can ever let go. But there's nothing in the law about that. There's nothing to help you. There's no place to, there's even the state police missing children's clearinghouse doesn't give you, the parent, any real path to recovery. Your child, you know, you can check the yellow pages, but that's about all there is. So lastly, I wanted to say a few things about my son, Aaron. In that he was, of my four kids, we were all very close, but he was the one that was most like me. We were like each other. Personality-wise, we were very much alike. And when I suffered depression and insomnia after the abduction, so did he. When I got to the point of suicide, so was he, the two of us. And you know, as parents, how difficult it is to find quality time with your child, and particularly when you've got a lot of kids, you know, and two different households. And we moved into Washington County from Clark County for one reason and one reason only, and that was to shorten the travel time between where My ex-wife had remarried and moved to Washington County and to shorten the travel time between the two houses. That's the only reason we moved to Washington County. And the thing is, Aaron needed that one-on-one time with me like I needed it too. And he worked, we had a system. So every Friday I picked up my kids after school. And on the way home, we do all our grocery shopping so that everybody got a chance to get whatever food they wanted for the weekend and everybody was happy. And we always did that. But my son Aaron, he figured out a plan where he checked with all the other kids to see what they wanted. And he made a deal with them that he would get whatever they wanted, and they'd just stay at the house with my mom. And my son and I would go to the grocery store, and we'd come back, and he'd distribute everything, and everybody was happy. And that came to an abrupt end on February 12, 1996, 19 years ago. In 2002, I was able to smuggle a cell phone to my son in Utah. And we started to have, it was the first time we were able to have regular communication. In 2003, he called me and told me that he's ready to come home, come and get him. So this was during the 2000 legislative session. And Senator Gordley, you know, gave me permission to, you know, leave her without staff and go bring my son home. And when I got there, he had his girlfriend and his best friend. And he said, "Dad, I want to come home with you. I don't want to ever come back here. But my friends, they got to come with me too. They got to get out of here too. They need to come too." And I said, "Okay, let's go." And then, you know, it took 3 days for them to pack. And these kids were all throwaway kids. They had prescription drug addictions, and they had prescriptions for those drugs. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. And when I brought them to my home in Portland and started to get a sense of the damage my son had suffered, I mean, you could look at him and see he was ill. You could see it. And so the rest of the time, every day, was finding medical help for my son. He had put himself in a methadone program back there. So every morning I drove him to the methadone clinic. I got him in the Oregon Health Plan and got him to Cascadia Behavioral Health Care and to a doctor at Providence. And for the first time he was starting to get some medical care. For the first time since he was abducted, he was starting to get some medical care. And he told me the whole history of what happened to him after he was taken to Utah. And when he was 15, he was hospitalized, suicidal ideation. The report, I only received two medical reports from any of my kids during all the time they were gone. And the first one was this one for Aaron. It was his intake report, and it described severe depression, suicidal ideation. It said that both of his upper arms were covered with the scars of self-inflicted knife wounds. Both of his upper arms. And he told me that when he was hospitalized, they started dosing him with Ritalin, Adderall, Prozac, Paxil, Xanax, Wellbutrin, and OxyContin. And then they got him, when he was fully dependent on OxyContin, all that got cut off. And he had to buy it on the street. And he said, "Dad, OxyContin is expensive, but heroin is cheap." And that's when he started using heroin. And all I ever tried to do in all these years was establish contact with my kids, get the joint custody order that had been in effect for 5 years before the abduction honored. And it never happened. And then, to make things even more complicated, both of my sons had enlisted in the Utah Army National Guard just prior to the September 11 attacks. And their unit was one of the first reserve units called up for deployment in 2003. And so with that complication, with Senator Gordley's help, we got permission from the Utah Army National Guard for Aaron's unit to release him to come out here to Oregon. and that's when we brought him out. And then, however, in November, his unit got orders for deployment. Now, Aaron was far too sick. I mean, he couldn't have held any kind of a job. He had a severe seizure disorder and a whole bunch of other medical problems that we were just trying to understand. And, however, he came downstairs and told me, "Dad, I've got orders, and I've got to join my unit, and I got to join my brother." And so on Thanksgiving Day, 2003, I watched my son pack, and the next day he was gone. And, you know, he drove from Portland all the way to Utah, dressed in his full-dress Army uniform. And who does that? Nobody does that. And that's the kind of son he was. And he actually passed the physical because he concealed all of his problems for them. You know, his unit was his family. That was the only family he had in Utah. And so he concealed everything from them and actually was approved for deployment. He passed the physical. And I was talking to him, you know, "Aaron, they're never going to let you go, you know, methadone, plus all these other meds that you need." And not only that, the day after he left for deployment, I received some mail from Providence Hospital from his doctor, and I opened it because I was paying all of his bills. And it was a letter warning him that if he missed up on his anti-seizure meds, then he'd suffer a seizure and go into a coma that he would not come out of. And that's the letter I got just after he left. And so here he was dependent on all of these meds, and he wouldn't tell anybody in his Army National Guard unit about it because he wanted to go. He wanted to serve his country and be with his brother. And they held him back for medical review, but sent his brother on to Iraq, where he was a 50 caliber machine gunner escorting convoys all up through the Sunni Triangle, and held my son back for medical review, which you would think included medical care. But because he wasn't actually activated for deployment, there was no medical care that went with that, and no pay either. So I'm still supporting my son from here and paying all of his bills and trying to get him medical care with no medical insurance in Utah, when if he was here, he was on the Oregon Health Plan with medical people in help. And so I have lost my train of thought. You know, I have lost my train of thought. But there came a time when I lost contact with them, and I could feel something was wrong. You know, you can feel it. And I contacted Jim Willis. He was head of the VA at that time. And I told him about my son and asked him if there was a way that the VA could do a welfare check on him, because I didn't want to ask the police, because the police had always been a problem in Utah on this. They'd always been a barrier. And Aaron was one of those, you know, those kids that don't fit, you know, and, you know, there was that too. So I wanted to have soldiers actually come and find him. And the following day, I got a phone call from Payson Police Department, and they found him comatose and unresponsive. And his friends had been knocking on the door and calling him for 3 days before somebody actually broke in and found him. And I flew back there the next day, and I was with him for 5 days. I didn't check into a motel room for 5 days. I was with my son until they declared him dead. And it was the first time I'd seen my other children in all these years. And here we are in ICU with my son in a coma and here's my other kids. And here we were gathered together, and first time we're seeing each other in all these years. And so they declared my son dead, and the coroner sent a report that he died of undetermined causes, and nobody was ever interested in finding out any more about that. I think that he died because he ran out of his prescription, his anti-seizure meds. I have no way of knowing, no way to find out. Nobody's interested back there. And the people that made all this happen, the people that were moving my kids around during that great storm of 1996, have just been back there in the shadows all along. But all I've been trying to do is recover my children. And I'm speaking for other people, not just my own family. You know, I've encountered others along the way. That you've seen my exhibits. I've put two other case studies in there of cases where here's a parent. Child is missing with another parent. They've reported it to the police, but the child hasn't turned up on the state police missing children's clearinghouse. Turned up on the national site, but not this one. And so there's that disconnect, you know, that also has to do with the statute. The confusion about what is protracted. A person, we're not just talking about parents here, we're talking about everybody involved in taking, enticing, and keeping the children. And so anyhow, I know I've talked a long time, and I just want to be quiet for a while.
Thank you for bringing this to us. And as Representative Smith Warner said, we need an amendment, so we won't move the bill today. But thank you again for coming in and sharing your tough story. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
Doing that to us, makes a difference. Thank you. Kevin Campbell.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I've known Sean for a long time. And I want to say that he's a good dad. That's something that I've always really appreciated about you, Sean, and I respect you for it. I hope I'm half the dad you are. And so 19 years after the day his children disappeared, this is a tough day. And so I just want to acknowledge that. I'm here because with regard to House Bill 2601, that's the bill that requires a report to the Missing Children's Clearinghouse within a 24-hour period. And so my purpose here is to support the intent of the bill, and yet I still have some questions just to make sure that the actual way this works in reality ends up working, because I know when a child is reported abducted now, it goes into LEDS, it goes into NCIS, so it goes both through state and federal channels. The clearinghouse is a little bit different, and so that's the question I have, is how quickly we can get that information over there and how they view that database. It is really designed for missing endangered and missing abducted children, and so they try to make sure that that's really what they're dealing with when they enter information into that missing children's clearinghouse. But I know that immediately when a child is reported abducted, there's a lot of things that occur, obviously, on the law enforcement side, where they are beginning to make determinations and mobilizing resources about the information that's available to them at the time. As you know, it can raise the level then of an Amber Alert. Amber Alert can occur when it's a clear abduction, and they, on top of that, they have vehicle information. Because obviously when they send out that alert, they are actually trying to direct law enforcement attention both within our state and further around a specific vehicle description where an abducted child may be there with a person. So I think my whole purpose for being here today is just make sure it works properly, but I can certainly understand the heart of what Sean and others are trying to accomplish here, and just want to work with proponents to work out the details. So.
Hey, thank you, and Representative Warner Smith is working on an amendment, so if you...
Okay, sure. Yeah. Fantastic.
Okay, thank you. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2601 and 2603 and open a work session on Senate on House Bill 2603.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2603 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2603 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any questions? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And Representative Smith Warner, would you carry that for us?
Please.
Thank you. Is there any further business?
I just want to say before we all leave, I want to thank Sean for the work that he did with Senator Gordley in this building. You guys really made a huge difference on the way we deal with folks who are in mental health crisis in the state, and so I just want to acknowledge that in addition to you being a good dad.
Thank you.
No further business before the committee, we stand adjourned. No further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.